Okay, so I'll just give an overview of some of the key issues for South Australia from a climate change adaptation perspective. This is really a very broad overview, and it serves as an introduction to more of the specific examples that we're going to hear about later on this morning. So we've got more specific science of adaptation given by scientists here, and then a range of on-ground and policy presentations given by government and local government representatives. So I also hold a joint position between the University of Adelaide and the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. So in some respects, I'm able to see the two sides of the coin, the dark side and the light side. And it's been quite an interesting junction operating on the edge of those two, because the scientists were often involved in an area of research, and you've really got to get involved in that area of research to make any headway. But then being involved on the government side keeps those policy and management angles much more front of mind. So we all know about the science of research. We wouldn't, the science of climate change, and we wouldn't be in the room today if we didn't. So I just wanted to emphasise just a couple of things with this. The first thing is that the climate system is currently changing faster than previously thought. So that is an important consideration. So rate of carbon dioxide accumulation, temperatures, Arctic sea ice, a range of indicators are actually tracking above the levels that are predicted by the worst case scenarios in global climate modelling. The second thing to bear in mind is if we change the mean, then we also change the frequency of rare and extreme events. So if you have the mean on the left-hand side here of an average where you get some extreme cold and hot events, if you shift the overall mean, those extreme hot events are going to become much more common because of the nature of that distribution curve of frequency of events. And then you're going to have those very, very hot events are going to become increasing in frequency as well, from non-existent to rare events. So we have a temperature challenge, but also some of the most difficult aspects to predict are around water. So we have some fairly sound and solid modelling for temperature predictions over time periods. But when it comes to rainfall, then we have an interaction between evaporation, rainfall, and then total water balance for an area. So these are predictions from CSIRO for South Australia. Obviously, as temperature increases, evaporation increases. So even if you get the same amount of rainfall, then the water budget within a system will decrease because the evaporation rates increase. Also, with rainfall, there are expected to be changes in rainfall, not only less rainfall, but then redistribution of rainfall around seasons. And so in places like South Australia, we may see decreasing winter rainfall and increasing summer rainfall as a very bland generalisation. But these redistribution of rainfall events around seasons are extremely difficult to predict. So we do have to take into account the inherent variability within the system. We know climate change is happening. We can make some overall predictions around that. But when it comes down to managing the system, we have to appreciate that there's going to be tremendous variability around what's going to roll out year after year. And that presents a real problem for managers and policymakers. It also presents problems for those defending the climate change, because, you know, we've seen this year, then we've got record rainfalls. Well, surely climate change has now stopped. You know, it's not stopped, it's still going, but it's part of the variability within the system. And part of that variability is also linked in with the El Niño and La Niña cycle. So we know we've switched over to a La Niña cycle, therefore the next year and hopefully the next 3 years will be a cooler, wetter time period, but we will be switching back into an El Niño cycle where it's going to become warmer and drier. So we have to have an understanding of these underlying drivers to the climate system. And I think policy managers and policymakers and managers also need to appreciate and are starting to appreciate the science behind those. But I think it's up to the scientists to help explain what are the critical elements within the system. So, changing temperature, precipitation, evaporation, fire regimes. Those are going to be the main climatic drivers and environmental drivers within the system. For biodiversity, that means a change in phenology. It means a change in the timings of species, flowering time, development time for plants and animals. But depending on the pressure, can also mean a change in the distribution of those species. So as Leslie emphasized, climate change is added on top of the current systems that already have problems. So fragmentation and invasive species are two other significant pressures on ecosystems that have been causing extinction over the last 50 to 100 years. And this is a diagram just taken from one of Barry's papers, where you have the extinctions or impact from fragmentation on its own on the left there. You might have an impact from climate change, which currently would be less than that. The additive effect would be the impact of those two together, but what we're expecting is a synergistic impact, where the overall impact is much greater than the additive impact of the two together, because the climate change impacts are just going to exacerbate the fragmented landscape and the problems with the fragmented landscape. So that's really the type of scenario we need to be thinking about. So to talk about some of the specifics for South Australia, so we know that phenology, the timing of reproduction, the timing of different life stage development has been changing for a range of species. This is work done looking at herbarium records from the South Australian herbarium here by a PhD student, Fran McGilway, on the diurus or donkey orchid. So records go back over 100 years for this particular species. And so by the other nice thing with the orchids is if they're in the herbarium, then they're flowering, because they're very difficult to identify from the vegetative stages. So you know all the records are flowering records, although Fran did check that. And secondly, in the field, the orchid only flowers for about 2 weeks. So a record within the herbarium has a timeline around that. And as we move to more recent times, and obviously we've got more records around which to make the estimations. So we see from this plot that over the last 20 years, that the flowering time of the orchid has got earlier by about 20 days over the last 20 years, whereas before that it was fluctuating around the mean, partially because there weren't enough records, partially because there was also an increase in El Nino events around about that tipping point in 1980. So we talked a little bit about tipping points. I think what we are going to see are interactions between climatic and environmental events that do tip certain systems, and then after that we see a change within systems. The other important thing about phenology is that it's very important for systems. A lot of co-adapted species rely on each other and the timings of each other's development to sustain an ecosystem. But not all those species are going to respond to those cues in the same way. And we've been looking at a data set from the Waite Arboretum here, where we have a range of different plant species, some exotic, but many native species. And some species keep flowering at the same time every year. And we know that some species, their flowering time is dictated by day length. Some species seem to be responding to temperature. Some are flowering earlier. Some are actually flowering later with increasing temperature. And some are responding to rainfall events. So we see quantitatively that different species are responding differently to these changing climatic events. That will also be the case for insects and mammals as well. So you've potentially got the situation where you've got a decoupling of the relationships between species, because they're responding in very different ways to these changing cues within the system. So the problem with that is you get lack of reproduction, lack of recruitment, and potentially local extinction in areas where the timing of life stages forces that life stage into a suboptimal period. So it might flay, produce a mature individual that doesn't develop in spring but develops in summer, and lack of rainfall curtails its life before it manages to reproduce. So you could get a local extinction event. So those are quite significant changes, but also very difficult to understand unless we have these types of long-term data to really look at the phenology of species, or indeed we're able to do experiments to look at phenological shifts. The other critical area, as Leslie pointed out, there will be a group of species that can sit there quite happily within a fair degree of temperature or rainfall change. Some will have physiological adaptation capacity, some will have evolutionary adaptation capacity, but there are going to be quite a large category of species that are going to migrate due to the climatic changes. Migration capacities and directions and trajectories are still the focus of quite a bit of research at the moment. But one simple example to think about is actually Goyder's line. So this is the line between productive and pastoral landscapes within Australia and non-productive systems. Peter Heyman has been doing some work to look at the change in Goyder's line over time. And it's actually been quite a difficult project to do because of the annual variation with the variation amongst seasons. But what we do see from a very general perspective is a more southerly shift in the distribution of species over time across that Goyder's line. And Peter and the Sardi group are in the process of redrawing the Goyder's line in more detail. Obviously, it's quite an iconic system, quite an iconic status for the state, so they want to be sure they've got that information correct. Also, what's generally used by scientists is a range of climatic modelling. So you look at the current distribution of the species, you look at the climate variables that are spread across the distribution, current distribution of the species, and then you use that to say, well, with a 1 degree temperature increase, this will be the distribution of those climatic variables across the landscape. This is some modelling work, very simplistic modelling work, done by Greg Gurin, comparing different modelling types, and we'll hear some other comparisons of different modelling types and next generation modelling that's really coming through later on. But overall, what we see for a range of species that are distributed more in the Mediterranean regions and mesic regions is a contraction of the range of those species. And if you're able to look at the distribution range across a whole range of species, then you're able to make an estimation of the multi-species refugia. And these are locations where a large number of species will persist despite the climatic changes that are predicted. So we saw some of the work, Stephen Williams, in the wet tropics. The work here in South Australia, we'll hear a bit more about that today, but we really need to do this type of mapping and bring it together for a broad range of species, plants, animals, and invertebrates in some case, for the state. And I think that is really a priority that we haven't really integrated so far. So from some of the work that Greg's been involved with, we've seen important Mediterranean species refugia in the Mount Lofty, the Flinders Ranges, even as far north as Wilpena Pound for some species, and then the southern tips of York and Eyre Peninsula and western Kangaroo Island. And so the mapping exercise needs to go further, not only the multi-species refugial location, but then how well these locations fit within the reserve system, what's their current conservation status. And we're really at the start of actually mapping those two exercises across. And then through the whole process, we need to keep in mind that some species are inherently going to move more or have better redistribution capacity than others. And those ones that are going to be most at risk or most vulnerable are those with a small geographic range, low dispersal capacity, small population size, and low genetic diversity. So it's not a simple task. It's got a range of variables to be pieced together into these types of action plans. Okay, so you've got the more simple responses, the phenology and distribution responses. You've then got the more unpredictable, the behaviours of invasive species and also fire. And both invasive species and fire have the potential to be major agents of ecosystem turnover. So if you get a fire going through a natural ecosystem followed by a wave of invasion, you will never recover that natural ecosystem again in some cases. Different frequencies of fire also dictate different ecosystem combinations. So both of these are very powerful drivers within ecosystems. Now, what we've seen within South Australia, work done at the State Herbarium, is over the last 20 years, approximately 1,000 new plant species have been discovered within South Australia. So a third of those are due to new taxonomy and taxonomic improvements. A third of those are due to the biological survey that's been undertaken to the state. So species that occur elsewhere in Australia have been discovered here in South Australia. But more worryingly, a third of that total, so more than 300 species, are actually new invasive species that have come into South Australia in the last 20 years. So this is a state that is prone to a range of invasions, and a lot of those species are actually in the pastoral regions. On the fire perspective, there has been concern, particularly around the Mount Lofty regions, following the Victorian bushfire event. So there is an undertaking to burn a proportion of the Mount Lofty ranges every year to keep the fire load and the fuel load down within the Mount Lofty ranges. Clearly that makes sense from a human perspective, to keep people safe within the hills and keep those communities safe. But we also need to be sure that the burning regime is not going to change ecosystems and cause extinctions, local extinctions of species that are critical to those habitats. So it has to be a balance between those two areas. And potentially, this is quite a lethal cocktail, a combination of inappropriate burning regimes together with invasive species for biodiversity within the region. Okay, and the other issues, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, historically within Australia, there have been a broad range of fire regimes. The invasive species is a relatively new problem over the last 200 years, but over the last 10,000, 100,000 years, we've had major climatic fluctuations that have occurred during the ice ages. Now, species have adapted or migrated across the landscapes naturally without huge extinction pressures, at least within the last 2 million years. One of the major changes that we're seeing now is an overall change within the landscape. So much more fragmented systems, and we haven't really got those large blocks of habitat which allow a certain amount of robustness and resilience within the system. So this is just some statistics for the Fluria Peninsula, about 12.5% of the remnant area remains. So if we think about refugial areas that might be located in the landscape, then there are two reasons why you would want to connect those. The first one is actually to increase population size. When you increase population size, you can increase the overall number of species that can reside within an area, but you also increase the genetic diversity and therefore the resilience of species within that location. Also, if you connect up areas, then you also allow migration for species for which migration is their only option for adaptation. So building around conservation areas, reserve areas, building up population size, building up the integrity and condition of those habitats through biodiversity corridors is still a good strategy, and it is still a strategy we need to consider. With biodiversity corridors, there can be a way, several different ways of doing that. You might have an agricultural matrix in between. You can attach those using simple biodiversity corridors. you may wish to extend the roadside verges or go for some kind of stepping stone ritual areas. And there are a range of different designs that we need to work through in that type of mosaic. And also some intermediate areas may actually facilitate gene flow or migration of species, even though they're kind of productive landscapes as well. So there's a huge amount to think about in terms of landscape design to help adapt to climate change. Okay, so within South Australia, there are five biodiversity corridors through the NatureLinks program that have been implemented through the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. In terms of the biogeographic location of these make sense in terms of the coherence of the ecosystems. Also, these biodiversity corridors have been built around the reserve system, so looking at the overall distribution of major blocks of protected land, and that was the first go at building these corridor systems. We can actually look at these corridor systems and then build on these for future conservation strategies. So this is just an example from the Eyre Peninsula here. We have in the red the east meets west corridor area, and just at the southern tip of the Eyre Peninsula and the northeast section of the Eyre Peninsula, we actually have areas of very high species richness that are protected within reserves in those lake locations, but are outside of the current biodiversity corridor, the east meets west corridor area. Because they weren't included, because the areas are already conserved. And when we look at a finer scale at the map, we see that the upper pink line there is the lower proportion of the East Meets West corridor, which is linking up a number of important reserve areas. And the southern tip of the Eyre Peninsula, where there's a large reserved area around the south there. Now, actually, in these two corridor areas, there are a significant number of heritage agreements which have been put in place. So these are people in the region that have properties that wish to turn them over to conservation concern. By highlighting the potential importance of the corridors in those areas, then a strategy to increase the heritage agreements in the area would actually facilitate that biodiversity corridor planning. So it wouldn't require the wholesale buying of areas. It requires information of the importance of the area and then implementation through strategies involving the community. And we just see on the back there the mapping of biodiversity values in the region, where the red values have the highest biodiversity value within the region. So some of those highest biodiversity values are actually in the most fragmented regions, and therefore should be a focus for conservation concern anyway in those areas. So if I was to come up with some key principles, we really need to be doing more work to identify the multi-species genetic and ecosystem refugia. So under climate change predictions, where are going to be the locations where species are located? Which are the locations which have high genetic diversity? Do those correspond to the refugial locations in the landscape? And are those locations going to represent the broad range of ecosystems that we have within South Australia? We really need to do that mapping in more detail. Once you've identified a range of those refugial locations, then the strategy would be around conserving and building up the population sizes around those refugial locations. That increases the resilience, both from populations and species levels, but also the genetic diversity within those locations. The second component, the interactions with invasives, phenological shifts and fire regimes, is a much more complex interaction. This involves the synergistic shifts that we've talked about, and really the only way to tackle this is to take some really good case studies and start to do some sophisticated modelling around that. And we'll hear a little bit about that in one of the case studies this morning. But again, in terms of general principles, large intact ecosystems are generally more resilient to these types of impacts than smaller ones. If you have a large ecosystem with many options for pollination, if one pollinator moves on, you've still got other pollinators within the system. Also, large intact ecosystems are more robust, as we've seen in practice, to the invasions of a particular weed species. So again, there are some basic principles that we're already applying for conservation that are relevant for climate change adaptation. We don't need to rewrite the book around the conservation policy. We need to look at what the conservation policies and practices that we're currently doing and how they are relevant to climate change, and just to tweak them to consider the climate change issues. And then the third one is around examining the migration trajectories, increasing the permeability of landscapes, such as biodiversity corridors, and then also considering assisted dispersal for some species, as we've seen. And once we identify the refugial areas and also areas where biodiversity corridors ought to be going, then that can be used as a guide for those restoration activities. But I guess one of the things I did want to emphasise is, these set of adaptation strategies will only work within a certain set of scenarios. So up to 2 degrees warming, 3 degrees warming maybe, but once we get, 4 degrees warming to 6 degrees warming, then it's only mitigation that's going to prevent that. The adaptation strategies that we come up with are not going to work within those extreme climate scenarios. I'll just spend 2 minutes quickly on a project that we have here within South Australia called TREND. It's a partnership between University of Adelaide, SARDI, South Australian Research and Development Institute, CSIRO, and the Department for Environment and Natural Resources. So a range of scientists involved and policymakers from those different organisations. TREND loosely stands for the Transect for Environmental Monitoring and Decision Making. And really it's this idea to establish a transect along an environmental gradient so that you can take space as a surrogate for time to see what happens in the northern part of a transect and make some predictions for what will happen in the southern part of the transect, seeing the changes in species combinations at those northern parts. So the transect is looking across terrestrial and marine and terrestrial production systems, and the implementation is really around plot or site monitoring, ecological site monitoring, but also using a number of genomics techniques and DNA barcoding techniques to look at species turnover and adaptation and resilience within those systems. The system is really designed in the first instance to establish transects for monitoring of those systems, but then to help elicit information along those transects so that we can start to provide good scientific information around the adaptation within those systems that can be fed into management and policy around those areas. And a second important component is also around engaging the community in climate change, the climate change debate, and the monitoring around those changes in the systems. So we have a system set up to design transect programs, feed into data storage and access, and then synthesis and analysis for decision making, which can be set up as an iterative adaptive management cycle for future decisions and for future information. And then feeding out that information to public communication and a citizen science strategy. So that's the overall intent. The terrestrial biodiversity transect, the TREND transect, is in the upper left-hand corner here. Basically, it's a bit dark. It goes from the top of the Mount Lofty regions up to Wilpena Pound. And as we can see in that second image, that's quite a strong rainfall gradient. But it's also an area of tremendous biological knowledge. There are something like 20,000 biological survey plots that have been established across South Australia, and most of those have been established through that region. It's also an area where the Heisen Trail runs, that red line along the map on the right-hand side there. So you've potentially got an area which has got huge numbers of visitors and walkers at the weekend going along that particular trail. Now, we're not coinciding the scientific plots together with locations where the general public could visit, but we are setting up areas that the general public could help monitor. And one of the novel developments for this is to try and develop an app for an iPhone or other such technology where somebody going out into the field would be notified when they approached a monitoring point, could take a photograph, an audio recording, or record data from that particular site. And that could either be uploaded directly, or if they're out of communication range, could be saved until they come back. And we're talking to the Friends of the Heysen Trail about how to roll this out along the Heysen Trail. But in general, it's not only the capture of information, but it's also being able to present information in the iPhone app, which would be information along the transect, interesting information around how the climate's changing, and potentially interesting information around the heritage along the Heysen Trail as well. So this is a project that was just funded last year. We've got 3 years worth to run on this. So we're starting out on quite an innovative strategy to bring together existing biodiversity and climatic data within a management and policy forum, but also engaging in this communication of climate change impacts. Okay, thanks.